Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs, bringing you 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live right now and then you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need, fast and focused. It's Thursday, the 5th of September. On the programme today, a new agreement promises to put more boots on the ground to fight crime in Cape Town. Question, of course, is will it work? Concern mounts about the state of artwork worth hundreds of millions of rands at the Johannesburg Art Gallery. Mpox vaccine inequality. It seems the world has learnt nothing from the COVID pandemic as African countries struggle to control the outbreak. And a 7 billion rand redevelopment of a historic airfield is set to give the Cape Winelands an economic boost. A cooperation agreement between the City of Cape Town, the Western Cape Government and the National Police Department is now in effect. Political parties will cooperate in what is termed the undertaking of research, development, procurement and commissioning of tech infrastructure, sharing of data, physical resources and skills. The Premier of the province, Alan Windey, is with me now. And first of all, Premier, what specific outcomes are you hoping to achieve?
So safety has been a big focus of mine since I became the Premier. So it's 5 years and we've put safety plans in place. We've got violence prevention programs. We even budgeting and deploying law enforcement officers in partnership with the city to the murder hotspots in the city of Cape Town. But what this memorandum, and I must give recognition to Alderman J.P. Smith in the city and MEC Henri Marais in the province for getting this to this space with the South African Police Services and then the National Minister, Minister Mchunu, is a very different environment under the new minister. And I really want to thank each of those parties who made this a reality. And really it is, it's a memorandum of understanding for the next 5 years. There are 10 areas of focus. And it's sort of, you know, whether it's joint planning, whether it's using technology, it's about strategy, integrated crime and violence prevention strategies and how we work on those strategies together. But for me, what really stands out is number one, that the ministers also agreed to look at legislation and regulation. And I've been talking about devolution of power. How do we play a stronger role? So I think that is really critical that, you know, right even to legislation is part of the agreement. How are we going to share data? Because you can't do policing with outdated data or historical data and then sharing data. So police have got their data. We use health data in our safety plan. That means our HECTUS measurement system in our hospitals measures where the ambulance picked you up, who made the call, what's the GIS mapping of that shooting, of that stabbing, of any of those crime activities that end up in our hospital. Gender-based violence gets processed through the HECTUS system, and that gives you the hotspots. And that's how we deploy according to the time and the place. So now we can do that together. And so I think this is the start of a journey of different policing in the city of Cape Town.
Premier, having said that, though, it is surely going to be difficult to navigate ongoing and historical tension between the city, the province, and national government on the issue of actual control when it comes to crime fighting.
Yeah, I mean, that is going to be an issue. It always has been. But when an agreement like this, what do they say? The tone comes from the top. So when an agreement like this takes place, it was interesting. The discussion at the Belhar sports field where we signed the agreement, straight afterwards the president left and there was the minister and myself and General Patakile, he's the provincial commissioner, and the various officials there, and we straight away were saying, how can we engage differently around deployment of officers? So immediately there was a difference in just having that discussion. And I mean, that's a discussion that we have not got right in the last 5 years. So that gives me the hope that we are going to find each other in so many more ways. And I mean, we must be frank about this. It's not going to be easy because it's about turf. And but if we all prepared to sit around the table and say it's in the interests of bringing crime rates down, well, then I think we can fight each other.
Let me ask you this question, Premier. How do you ensure that this cooperation agreement is more than just a symbolic gesture or a political stunt? What tangible results should citizens expect to see within the next 12 months?
Well, I think that, I mean, obviously everything gets measured at the end of the day by crime statistics and crime data. And if we can start to get that focus right, where we all looking at a certain aspect of crime and saying, well, let's zoom in. And I'm always the one that says, you know, rather choose one space, focus on it and say, can we move the needle? If we can get that right in the next year, you will start to see some changes in the numbers. I mean, I already know that if we track the last 5 years of where our LEAP officers are deployed, we have a, in the province, we actually in 5 years, there's a 50% increase in general on murder statistics, but we've got a 30% increase in the hotspots where the LEAP officers, so we know is a difference. It is not where we need it to be, but it means that the growth is slower in those areas. So how do we take that data, add some more change and focus back in those areas? And it's that data that at the end of the day is really going to give you the measurement and say, are we succeeding?
Premier, not just in the Western Cape, but countrywide, it's often business that feels the brunt of crime. What is your call to business in terms of this process going forward now? And what greater role do you think it can play in order to make sure that they can simply keep their doors open and turn a profit, I guess?
So I think you would have seen at the signing, Business Against Crime is part of it. And I think that is really a critical component, as well as citizens. So it is about a whole of society. We've all got to be playing our part here. But I think that, you know, businesses also got the business that needs a safer environment in which to operate. They need a safer environment in which, you know, their customers or their staff operate in. And so it is critical that business is a partner here. And then also understanding how do we bring in the business sector that is in security and in safety in a way that they understand that if we are really successful, that their own businesses are going to shrink. And I mean, the real statistic is the 200,000 police officers in our country and the over 650,000 people that work in the private security industry. You've seen those numbers growing exponentially. So business is investing massively in, because they pay for these security guards, etc. And so it is also, I think, from a bottom line point of view, it is really important that business is involved. We've got to reduce crime to make it more conducive to do business, and it makes good business sense. In a government, it makes good business sense. You know, the securing of our infrastructure sites with extortion and criminality that takes place where government is building schools, hospitals, and roads, in the last 5 years, it's just short of R1 billion that we've been spending on safety and securing those areas. That is money that should be spent on benefit for citizens. So, you know, whether it's business or government, we're spending way too much money on security, and we need to join forces so that we actually make it safer to do business.
This is a big, bold plan, but it's also about changing perception. You mentioned extortion. Let me throw into that mass shooting and also drug-related crimes plaguing Cape Town and beyond. How do you set an achievable priority as far as this is concerned about where the agreement needs to place its focus?
So, I mean, so the plan itself is, you know, a broad high level. And now what happens is the work has got to be within that plan. So if I look at 5.2 of the areas of cooperation, the development of programs, plans, interventions, and infrastructure that will reduce the levels of crime. So that's quite broad. Now we need to sit down and say, all right, what are we going to focus on? You speak about extortion. How's the extortion plan of the last 5 years has not delivered results? What is the extortion plan going forward? And I think there's something that I want to mention that's not in this plan of which we have to get right, which is the next leg. And that is how we link from a policing component to the whole criminal justice system, because it's also about how the courts operate, how the investigations happen and make it stick. And it's going to end up with a consequence. There's going to be a jail time. You know, there needs to be consequences. So there's actually even more that's got to happen on top of it. But I think this agreement is a great start of saying if we don't work together, we will never reach a time where we see reductions in crime. We've got to turn the corner. And I think it's got to the stage where there's been enough fighting. And, you know, it's probably helping us, a product of a national coalition. So it's forcing us to say, listen, you know, you can't just fight here. You've got to make sure that you work together. And so, yeah, it's, and in some ways, it's new territory. The city and the province have been building on this for a long time. We've got the data to show it. And now if we really build that partnership with the police, it's going to definitely make a difference. I'm convinced of it.
Alan Windey is the Premier of the Western Cape. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And let me stay in the province, and a 7 billion rand investment will see a historic airfield just outside of Durbanville in Cape Town transformed eventually into a fully-fledged airport offering, I'm told, local and international flights. 2 years away, 2027. The Cape Winelands Airport currently serves as a general aviation facility and a popular destination for flight training, but things are going to change, and we'll see an expansion that we read will exceed the size and the capacity of Lanseria Airport here in Gauteng. Nick Ferguson is with us now, Managing Director of the Cape Winelands Airport. Nick, welcome to you. What then are the primary benefits for establishing this new facility?
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you very much for your time. The primary benefits for a facility, you know, of this nature in Cape Town are around diversion benefits. And that's it's a very unique model that we have, you know, uncovered, being very distant from alternate airports. So to give you an example, a Boeing 777 that is leaving Dubai, before it takes off, lodges a flight plan. And in that flight plan, they lodge an alternate destination airport. And that is if they get to their destination, which in this case is Cape Town, and they are forced to turn around, they need to have enough fuel to fly to an alternate airport. Bigger planes like the 777s or, you know, Emirates in this case would fly to Johannesburg, to OR Tambo. They carry 10 tons of fuel in order to divert to Joburg. They burn between 2 and 4 tons of that fuel just by carrying the fuel, just by carrying 10 tons. They burn between 2 and 4 tons, costing them approximately 100,000 rand in fuel burn per flight. Obviously, when you burn fuel, you emit carbon emissions and you bad on the environment. But the real kicker is that they would not carry 10 tons of fuel, call it cargo fuel back and forward. They would carry 10 tons of payload. So, yeah. So
but Nick, it's not just a supplementary solution. I mean, there's a huge opportunity here for local carriers to use the airport to take people directly to an area where they want to go.
Of course. So, you know, if you live in that area, you would prefer to fly to an airport which is closer to you. You know, when I was going up to Joburg and my family were living there, I used to choose Lanseria above OR Tambo because it made more sense for me. So there's a number of benefits other than it's actually in fact a 10-minute shorter flying route from Johannesburg to Cape Town. Currently, most planes that come into, or all planes that come into Cape Town on runway 19 are having to go around Tigerberg Hill, which adds an extra 10 minutes to the flight.
Nick Ferguson, is this airline, or this airport, should I say, in direct competition now with Cape Town International?
So we did a traffic forecast. Well, we didn't do it. We employed specialist consultants out of the Netherlands who looked at our airport and did a forecast going to 2050. Essentially, that forecast said that the market, what it said is the market in Cape Town is at 10 million passengers currently. The market will go to 20 million passengers by 2050. We will go from 0 to 5, and Cape Town International will go to from 10 to 15. So we will control 25% of the market. That's what this independent specialist said. But realistically, we, you know, would attract one in every two new passengers. to the area.
A 7 billion rand investment, who's behind it and where does the money come from?
So the money would come from essentially what we are able to do, which is almost not able to do. You can't do it unless you're a government. So we essentially are able to take those agreements that we have for airlines where we share in this value creation, and we are able to use those agreements to fund the initial infrastructure, which is the 7 billion rand. That 7 billion rand gives us a runway, a taxiway, a small terminal building, and a serviced, call it aviation or serviced airport.
Nick, I'm not quite following you. Is this a government guarantee or is this simply the South African government paying for it?
No. So it's got nothing to do with the government. We would enter into a long-term agreement with the airlines. For instance, the Emirates, which I briefly talked about, where we, by us building this airport, we save them money and we allow them an opportunity to create more revenue. So we say to them, we will take a portion of it and you take a portion of it. It's like, Jeremy, if I say to you, I'm going to give you 100 rand, will you give me 50 back? And the answer is of course, yes. Everyone will give it back. We will use the 50 that we get back on a long-term agreement with the airlines. So effectively, it's backed by the airlines. And we will discount that, that will be used to fund the initial infrastructure.
Apart from Emirates, who else has thrown their hat into the ring?
So we're speaking to obviously every airline that that flies direct to Cape Town. So Lufthansa, British Airways, KLM, Delta. So it's every airline, but of the traffic, there's 14 airlines that fly direct into Cape Town. Approximately five of them make up 80% of the traffic.
Would the local carriers be part of this split or guarantee that you're talking about?
Yes, they would. So we're speaking to Safair and Airlink, and of course they benefit. They don't benefit to the same quantums. Obviously, it's dependent on the distance that they have to fly, because the further they're flying, the more fuel they actually burn, and it's dependent on the type of airplane that they fly. So a smaller airplane wouldn't benefit the same amount, but it's obviously it adds up, and it's a significant amount for these airlines. They are on very tight margins, and anything helps.
All right. Interesting funding model. Nick Ferguson, let's see how it goes. MD Cape Winelands Airport, appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the Johannesburg Art Gallery houses one of the most important art collections on the continent, pieces by the likes of Picasso, Monet, Sekoto, Pienaar, and Kentridge. But the collection, worth hundreds of millions of rand, is at risk of serious damage due to improper storage that fails to protect and preserve some of these gems. And some artworks have already been damaged beyond repair. The Johannesburg Heritage Foundation and non-profit company Friends of the Johannesburg Gallery have now enlisted the services of a law firm. They've sent a letter to the mayor of the city demanding urgent intervention. Eben Kuhn is with us now on behalf of Friends of the Johannesburg Art Gallery. So what has led the art gallery to reach this critical state of repair? Eben, welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. I think over the last decade, what we've seen is botched reparations to the building that leads to losing a wing of the building at a time. And it's a marvelous, exquisite collection that is so big, and it's always been too big for the building. You've got a city of people that is extremely proud of this collection, and through various trusts and individuals have continued to add to this collection, but the collection simply cannot be stored in the current building any longer. The storerooms are inadequate, leaks water. If you go into some of the wings that's been damaged, by water seeping into the building from underneath, as well as botched roof repairs, then it's very clear that this collection can no longer be housed in the current building as it stands.
So you're looking for urgent intervention from the city. What specifically do you want?
So we've got all the financial means to move the collection temporarily to a place of safety, which would fall under the national government, in order for it to be stabilized, that is, restored, digitized, evaluated. And then that's the first part of our demand to the city. And the second part of our demand to the city is that we believe that it's time to relook the governance structure of this organization, or in order to uphold this institution, to form something like a multi-stakeholder partnership. So we've got lots of cultural agencies, we've got corporates willing to help fund the future of JAG, but the institution at the moment is not successful and isn't sustainable because of how it sits in the city's governance structure.
It's regrettable that you've had to go the legal route.
Yes, we have tried on several occasions. Ourselves have tried, corporates have tried, other people have tried, and unfortunately, the governance is the real long-term issue here. There's incredible people working on the ground inside of the museum that, despite all of the problems, still managed to put on a brave face, put up beautiful exhibitions like the one that's there at the moment, which is a photographer's work, not part of the JAG collection. So just to make that clear, we don't want the building to be steamrolled. There are some halls that can still be used for contemporary cultural production. But in the long run, we will need to look at a satellite facility for this.
Have you heard from the mayor's office yet?
Unfortunately not yet, according to Weber Wenzel, our lawyers.
So what's the next step?
The next step is really for us to continue the legal route. If we can't get a response from the mayor, we ask for a meeting on more than one occasion, then follow the legal route. It is also a challenge, obviously, that the government changes all the time in our city, so you're not talking to the same people. What helps with the legal process is, even if there are people who change, the process must continue. So we're hoping to get in the near future an order from a court that helps the city to make the decision to follow the plan that we're putting on the table. We're not asking the city to fund this. Funding is available to do the work, but we need the city to agree to work with the stakeholders. There's a very interesting thing that I just want to highlight, and that is that this collection belongs to the people of the city of Joburg. It was left in 1908 to all of us. It's our collection, and it's left in the custody of the city under very specific conditions, which includes that the mayor is meant to chair a specific committee that looks at the art gallery and its well-being. That hasn't been the case for the last two decades at least, and so we're saying that it is really time that we need to force the hand of the city to make the right decisions in terms of the governance of this institution, as well as safeguarding the collection.
Well, we'll certainly be putting a phone call through to the mayor's office, but very quickly, you have 9,000 artworks right now improperly stored. The rainy season is upon us. What's the plan?
The plan is that we want to move it as soon as possible to this national facility, which.
But if you can't, then that's the question I'm asking you.
Some of those will get destroyed, because we know that the moment the rainy season starts, water seeps into the building, and the staff at JAG literally has to move things around. That's what they've been doing for the last 2 years. The city called all stakeholders 2 years ago and told us that they understand the urgency. Nothing's happened for 2 years.
Looking forward to that conversation with the mayor's office. Eben Kern, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Attention, all investors and finance enthusiasts. Get ready for the annual Money Summit, Africa's largest and most influential savings and investment event. Join me, Jeremy Maggs, on Tuesday, the 10th of September at the Sandton Convention Center, as we connect with over 100 top chief executives and industry leaders across 20 exciting conferences and forums, all in one incredible day. Secure your spot now. Register online at www.moneysummit.co.za for free with the code MoneyWebGuest. This is your chance to be part of Africa's premier savings and investment event. Don't miss it.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
This is our last story today. Have we learned nothing from the pandemic? It's a question being asked by leading health experts as Africa continues to struggle to secure Mpox vaccines. In conversation now with Dr. Nduduzo Dube, Director of Quality Management and Clinical Operations at the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. And first of all, Dr. Dube, why is Africa struggling in this respect? What's the problem here?
The problem begins with what we call intellectual protection rights, where European countries through the World Trade Organization agree that whatever technology they develop that side, they will not share it with other countries. They will make sure that it's kept within their country so that they can make the most money out of it. So now with vaccines for diseases that affect mostly Africans, they still want to produce these vaccines in Europe, which makes it even more difficult to distribute them because, remember, they have to be distributed through a cold chain, frozen at minus 40 degrees and all those things. So what we're saying is basically to say, can we overlook profit over human lives and allow these companies to at least share the technology so that vaccines can be produced in Africa for diseases, especially that are affecting poor countries like Africa.
And Dr. Dube, the tragedy of that, in spite of you making the call and many others, that of course is unlikely to happen.
Yeah, as an organization, we have been using advocacy to push for humanitarian interventions, just like for HIV. We pushed for the sharing of patents for drugs to be produced cheaper so that they could be accessible for Africans. Because these diseases don't know any boundaries. Viruses don't know any boundaries. If you don't control the diseases when it started, it can still come to your shores. So even if you are still making profit, the disease can still come to your shores. But yet if you could manage to contain it, like right now in DRC, if we could and at all the people around that area, the disease can be easily controlled such that it cannot reach any European countries or other European countries. So whether it's big pharma, drug companies, they should think about that. Countries that are protecting these big pharmaceutical companies should think about that because they are not safe if we don't control the disease where it started.
If this advocacy is not successful and the trajectory of a disease like Mpox continues, what is the consequence, Dr. Dube?
The consequence is that we are going to end up having another pandemic like COVID, which affects everyone, which affects business, which affects life generally, where we have to be quarantined, people have travel restrictions. You know, the world comes to a standstill if we have to put up lockdowns and quarantine people and restrict travel. It affects a lot of people. It causes a lot of harm. Even controlling diseases like TB and HIV is also affected when we have those kind of lockdowns and quarantines. We lost a lot of people. We lost with the infection rates rising for HIV and for TB during COVID-19. So the world is not safe. Even all types of business are not safe. Air industry, tourism, every industry becomes affected. So we need to control diseases as early as we possibly can, keep them localized like we have right now, and make sure that we control it within that. We need to vaccinate people in DRC.
Doctor, are there specific reforms, and I would like to come back to the DRC in a moment, but are there specific reforms, in your opinion, that are needed within international health agencies like the WHO, for instance, that can address this vaccine inequity with more speed?
Yeah, I would say World Health Organization, who actually holds the keys to this problem, who has to make sure that they revive the pandemic agreement. This is basically a proposed international framework that is designed to strengthen global pandemic prevention and preparedness. So who has to detect, I mean, among the 196 countries that are signatory to WHO, we have to make that agreement where there is agreement that there would be forceful, or I would say legally binding policies that says that for any vaccine that aimed at controlling a pandemic, there should be an agreement that allows any country that has developed the technology to share it with the region that is affected so that the disease there, the vaccine can be produced in that region. And then there should also be what we call pathogen access and benefit sharing system. This basically means that if I have got information about the certain pathogen of virus, I should be able to share it with other companies that can easily produce the diagnostic tools or drugs or even vaccines that can control that disease, people tend to withhold that so that they can be the only ones that can produce that vaccine, so that they're the only ones that can make that profit. So all those things should be driven by who should be at the forefront.
Yet it's not happening. Do you think there is a lack of appetite within the World Health Organization to make that happen?
They do also suffer a bit of some pressure from other developed countries that contribute more. The WHO fund is like a basket where the kind of countries that pledge more. So those countries that pledge more, they will probably want to have a voice or want to be protected, or want their companies, or drug companies to be protected so that they don't easily or they're not forced to share these drug patents so that they continue making insurmountable profits, that because they are the ones that are holding keys to these patents. So those are some of the pressures, but I think we are lobbying that WHO should take control of this and put humanitarian or life ahead of profit. So it shouldn't be the issue of protecting certain industries, or protecting certain patents, but the issue of trying to save human lives and make sure that we don't suffer or pandemics are controlled.
Right. Dr. Dube, just a very quick answer, if you please. You did mention the Democratic Republic of Congo. How concerned are you about this new Mpox variant?
So we actually have a new variant, which is called GLID 1B. It seems to be more transmissible and more virulent, and it's affecting mostly children, and it has been shown to spread among school children because they tend to have close contact together in school. So most of the cases, actually 90% of the cases that we're talking about in 18 countries that have recorded cases right now, in actually DRC, and the 97% of the deaths are actually in DRC. So it's sort of still a bit localized, even though it's spreading towards the east, Uganda and Kenya, and also spreading towards the west. It's coming in Nigeria and as far as Liberia, I think. But it can still be controlled if you can vaccinate people around there. So we are having almost 22,000 cases that have been reported in DRC, and a few other cases that have been reported in other countries. South Africa is the only country that is an outlier, that is outside that region, that has reported cases, mostly for two reasons, because there's a lot of travel to South Africa. South Africa is an economic hub, or in Africa, basically. So we get a lot of people traveling to South Africa. And because of it, also economic activity and road network, once a case comes here, it can easily to the whole of the country. So
right.
South Africa is one of the few countries that has reported cases. And also because we've got good surveillance and technology to detect some of these diseases, we tend to detect them and then report them then other than other countries that might not be.
All right. Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Nduduzo Dube, Director Quality Management and Clinical Operations at the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. Thank you very much. And just before I leave you, on our online poll today, the Cape Winelands Airport, we were discussing that earlier. My question to you, is it much needed? Do you think it's going to be a white elephant, or do you have cost concerns? If you have a view on that, please visit either our X or LinkedIn pages. That is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.